Thank you, Nicholas, for organizing a highly regarded forum, both on speakers and topics. I would like to thank our panelists for participating with me in this panel, and I would like to present them briefly now. To my left, Ilias Triantafylidis, Regional Bulk Carrier Segment Director for Southeast Europe Region from DNV Maritime, Dr. Gabi Borheim, President of the German Ship Owner Association, Tim Wilkins, Managing Director of Intertanko, Gordon Robertson, Head of Greece, North Standard, and last, Joe Kramek, President and CEO of World Shipping Council. A highly regarded panel, and thank them again for traveling to Greece to discuss with us some interesting issues of shipping and trade today. Ladies and gentlemen, shipping keeps recovering from crisis after crisis, from the COVID-19 to the economic impact and energy crisis resulting from the Russian-Ukraine conflict, the Black Sea, the Red Sea, challenges, work risk environment, coping also with the urgent matters of climate change and decarbonization. Moreover, even as early as it is, there may be an agenda under the new USA administration that may create unforeseen development in shipping and trading. On top, limitation of qualified, educated, and well-trained human resources on board and ashore, in combination with the new technologies, digitization on board and artificial intelligence, are bound to have a transformational impact on the future of the shipping industry and its manpower. Historically, the shipping industry has been proven flexible, resilient, and adaptable to the political, geopolitical, and regulatory challenges that have been affecting the world and the transportation of goods. It seems that maybe many open challenges in the current environment, including also the dry sector, that seems to be having problems with charter rates and fees. We are going to concentrate in three major topics: geopolitical issues, trade and shipping, green shipping and sustainability, and end up with human resources. And enough from me, I'm now turning to our panelists, and I will start with Gabi on geopolitical issues. And I would like us to comment on the current geopolitical uncertainties, including trade tensions, conflicts, regional conflicts. How do you see developments reshaping the shipping, global shipping patterns, and what ship owners, since you are German ship owner head, how they can prepare for these changes?
Thank you, Michaelis, for having me, and it's a pleasure to come here to the nice city of Athens. Geopolitical uncertainties, I think this is even not the right expression, because it's really weird what we have to see, and it will reshape the global trade, and we have to expect rerouting. But we can also see that might be some expectations will be filled, and that we have seen with the Red Sea. I think for more than 1 year, the Houthi rebels were attacking our vessels, and we were adapting, rerouting our vessels to the disadvantage of higher costs, higher emissions. And now we can see that there is at least the chance that the ceasefire between Israel and Hamas will turn out to a positive effect. And if so, I think we can also only pray for that, then we will hopefully see a new decade starting, or a new, a better trading in this area again, so that the Red Sea will come to what it has been before these attacks, before these Houthi rebels attacking us. But we can also not only see that it's the Red Sea, we have also now with the Trump election and the first announcements that we have Charis again, his lovely, most lovely word he uses. These tariffs will also show that we go back to a protectionist regime, and this is by far not good for our industry. It is against the free trade. And so we will have to adapt, we will have to find new trade partners, because, Canada, Mexico, they have all been on the list by the U.S. So what we have to do is we have to look around and we have to analyze much better what is coming out of that. And we have also, besides this, situation in the Taiwan Strait. And we have to see what happens in the Baltic Sea. That is not only an uncertainty, that is a kind of war taking place there, because we don't know what these attacks will mean and to what they will lead. So what can we do? We can only join forces. We have to see how we can better collaborate, how we can get immediately information about geopolitical risks and anything what is happening. I think that is something we have to make ourselves resilient.
You hit the magic word, collaboration. That's, I think, the most important. Elias, in continuation on these geopolitical shifts and impacts, from the DMV perspective, how did companies, shipping companies, address these challenges, and what is the impact on the world fleet?
Thank you, Michalis. Nice to be with you here in this panel. Well, basically, what we've seen is that all the companies have invested heavily in technology. They have also practically made strategic partnerships and alliances, and they have been monitoring very closely all these geopolitical events in order to decide the fleet strategy to achieve the maximum performance and, of course, resilience. Although there have been many different decisions for each company, there have been some very strong trends. If we analyze a little bit on the new building market, we've seen a boom in the new building orders back in 23 and 24. These vessels were split, and less than maybe 50% were dual fuel capable, utilizing an alternative fuel, a new fuel. And this is a clear signal to the industry that the that they don't feel ready to invest in not mature or not available technologies and fuels. The other trend was concerning the retention of the older fleet, which was significantly improved in terms of efficiency to meet the requirements of the stakeholders. And there we have a significant involvement of S&P in meeting the growth in ton-mile demand. We've seen that in the last 4 years, there have been a huge increase in the S&P, and we have seen trends. For example, Greeks became the sellers, Chinese the buyers. So you can understand that having such a complicated and demanding legislation, especially in Europe, has influenced a lot the shipping companies in their strategy. Finally, another very important phenomenon was the subdued scrapping of vessels. So basically, a lot of the older vessels that are at the end of their life cycles remain still in the market. And I believe if these geopolitical challenges continue, they will be the first to sacrifice in order to maintain, you know, which is,
yes,
again, we can say there is a safety net and there is a resilient wave for shipping to continue.
Thank you, Elias. I see that adaptability all of these measures to adapt to. Now I go to team Intertanko. Now the mechanism of implementing sanction has a name, tankers, in the last few years. How your members adapt to this constantly changing sanction landscape and the evolution of the Shadow fleet, and what Intertanko,
how
Intertanko assists.
Yeah, thank you, Michalis. I think it is constantly changing, but I see two phases from an Intertanko's perspective, and we're now entering the second phase. But let me explain what the first phase was, and you talked about agility and adaptability. And I think it's a really important point to make here about how the industry, particularly Intertanko's members, and as an owners association, we've adapted swiftly to the changes since 2022. Starting initially with looking at the issue from a perspective of risk, mitigating compliance risk initially, pooling resources, a group of tanker owners pooling resources to share due diligence processes, to share effective sanctions charter party clauses, and develop standards for the tanker industry, for Intertanko's members, to make sure that the regulators who were issuing these sanctions requirements, particularly Russian sanctions, understood where the reputable owners were and what lines were being drawn between what was the best practice for due diligence for a reputable tanker company and what was not. So that was the first phase, going into that with our eyes open, sharing information, setting the standards initially, all the while liaising directly with the regulators who are issuing these guidelines, not to simply learn and understand the regulations, but to inform the regulators as well, and inform them about our industry, and in particular, the members that we represented. All the while, that was the compliance risk side of things. We've also focused on the reputational risk, the reputation of our members and the reputation of the tanker industry as a whole. And to do that, it's been very important to try and define what we mean when we talk about the shadow fleet. And I can see you smiling, Michalis, because we were talking about this before, and it's not an easy one. Gordon might have some comments on it as well. And we're still struggling with that, but at least we're trying, at least we're making a difference. We've worked with, collaborated with member states of the IMO. We have an assembly resolution which was released in 2023, which stands the test of time. It was based initially on a statement that Intertanko had released on its website. And fairly, I think, defines what the shadow fleet is. So we've been busy working on this risk mitigation for compliance and risk mitigation for the reputation. But now we're moving into a second phase, absolutely moving into a second phase, where we are seeing member states being more proactive about clamping down on the shadow fleet. We have also worked with member states when we see a common objective. We have signed a paper with the EU member states into the IMO's legal committee to look at methods and mechanisms for taking the shadow fleet out of the situation. And we are looking for other opportunities, and we're looking for other opportunities to coordinate, for example, the littoral states in the Baltic as one option, where we may be able to work with them, but also establish a very clear line between what we're talking about. So I think, yeah, we've had the narrative. I think the way that we've adapted, the agility that we've shown, I think it puts us in good shape to tackle the challenges that we have right now as we go towards abandonment, as well as we go towards the Trump 2.0
requirements. But on this sanction compliance, since next to you is Gordon, who is a PNI North Standard, is that becoming too great, and can owners rely on you guys, the insurance, to keep them out of trouble, Gordon, on this sanction compliance?
Thank you very much. Is the burden becoming too great? I don't think it's that the burden is becoming necessarily too great, but it's certainly an increasing burden. I think it's something that people are talking about a great deal more now than we were 10 years ago, 20 years ago. And I would say as well that also it's quite a volatile burden. It's a very, you know, changeable burden. I mean, let's be honest, Lee Hansen's talking at the end of today on sanctions. She's the real expert, and the situation between now and then might have changed, depending on which side of the bed someone gets out of in the US later today. So things could change dramatically in a very short period of time. The simple point is owners must get it right. And there are a great deal of a number of tools and new tools and platforms that people can use now to help them get it right. I don't think that it's too big a burden. I just think it's a bigger part of the trade and a bigger part of the process behind agreeing to do those trades that you do need to perform that level of due diligence. In terms of whether their owners can rely on their insurers, well, they can rely on us to assist. They can rely on us to potentially help them spot red flags or help them through the process. But the simple point to make about an insurer when they're doing their due diligence is they're looking at it from their perspective and what impact it's going to have on them. And the owner needs to look at it from their perspective with all the information that they have about their structure and the people they're working with. And the simple point about it is that DD has, you know, due diligence has two functions. One, to figure out whether you can do something in the first place. But there's the other function that it has, that if something goes wrong during the trade, after you've loaded the cargo, something changes on voyage, something comes to light on voyage, and a sanctions breach occurs, the due diligence protects the owner from the enforcement by the authorities. And if the owner has done their own due diligence, they have a level of protection there. If they turn around to the authorities and say, oh, our hull insurer, our war insurer said it was okay, it's not going to cut it. And, you know, unfortunately, that's when the regulators and the authorities throw the book at people. And that is the thing that we need to make sure our owners avoid.
Yes. That's exactly why we set about setting the standard for the tanker industry to be able to demonstrate what level of due diligence should be in place when the regulators come and they say, well, what did you do? And I think that's an important point to make.
It's a very good point. But also, we must remember, you know, due diligence is about the state of the art at the time. And the state of the art of due diligence is evolving constantly. You know, we now see people being able to spot VHF signals around STS operations from satellite. You know, that's not something that was happening 5 years ago. You know, the state of the art and people doing due diligence is different now and continues to evolve. So that's why I'm saying, you know, it is a burden that just keeps on giving, unfortunately.
Thank you both. John, let's finish the first section here on geopolitics. Now, 2025 started with some interesting events, new Trump presidency, the de-escalation of the Red Sea trade, and in your experience from World Shipping Council, what do you expect shipping sectors, liners, dry bulk, tankers, how they will respond to this new era?
Sure. First, I'd just like to thank the hosts. It's very wonderful to be here in Athens and with all of you, so thank you. from the liner shipping perspective, when you look out across the horizon, trading globally is tremendously challenging as you go across the world, as we've all experienced. We see tremendous opportunity because trade overall worldwide has been steadily increasing the volume from 3 to 4% fairly steadily. So it's important to say that we see trade continuing to rise at that steady volume. So with demand, these industries, liner and others that you, that are sitting here today and represented in the audience, that demand will continue. And in many ways, maybe this has become business as usual, is navigating these geopolitical waters as we move along to keep the trade flowing. We rerouted around the Red Sea. Most of liner shipping hasn't gone back yet. They're continuing to assess it, but there's such a tremendous advantage to being able to do so. They would welcome that opportunity, and some of our member companies assess that on a day-to-day basis to see if they can. I just testified in front of the U.S. Senate on a Panama Canal hearing. You see what's going on there. It's a very active space. So we went from low water in the Panama Canal to now a geopolitical tension that we didn't even know existed from a commercial perspective. So I think if we continue to adapt, and perhaps there's opportunities to take advantage of those opportunities, because shipping is a flexible asset and they move around, and we're able to do that to keep the trade flowing.
Thank you, Thank you, Joe. So, concluding this, I put four keywords: collaboration, adaptability, reputation, and due diligence, to go to the next step. Now we are going to green shipping and sustainability, and I will start with Gabby again. What do you see the biggest challenges for ship owners in meeting the ambitious developments of IMO 2050, and are there specific opportunities for European and other ship owners to take a leading role in the new era of green environment in shipping, Gabby?
Sometimes it feels like being a parrot because we have to reiterate it again and again. Okay, by 2050 latest, shipping industry will be decarbonized, but how can we do? How can we achieve? We all know that the alternative fuels are not there. And we are not the only ones fighting for them or wanting them. So this means, at least it is not only a financial burden to get them, it is even more because they are not there. And we have to all to, again, collaborate and, I think, to invest to get these alternative fuels. But what is even more decisive, in my view, is that we have, unfortunately, although I love Europe and the European idea, it is difficult to have this regional ETS, the European Trading System, and now Fuel EU Maritime, because we all know, being in this industry, it's overall, it's worldwide trade. It's not only limited to Europe. And if we are only required or to follow EU ETS, it is meant to accelerate the green transition, but in my view, it makes it absolutely difficult because the regional nature of these kind of regulations is harming our business. And we don't need different standards. We need an overall international rule, and therefore we have all to unite our forces in Europe and worldwide to have international rules. That is key in this perspective. And then I think we have to follow a dual strategy that we also engage not only with the international bodies, as stated, but also that we do investments, that we invest and that we also ask others to invest, and that we collaborate, for example, with ports, because there we need the new fuels. And if they are not prepared, it will not help.
Yes, thank you. Understandable. Elias, besides the regulatory framework, what are the main drivers now in maritime green transition and the key elements that you see?
Yes, Michal, basically the main drivers should be the cargo handlers, cargo owners, and charterers, and their ESG agenda that is pushing forward decarbonization in shipping these days. What we've seen, if we analyze a little bit the three elements, the three pillars of decarbonization, if we split them down in basically energy efficiency, which also incorporates operational measures, dropping fuels, and then uptake of new fuels, we have done a research as the NVE, and we have seen that there is a great potential and as a transition to alternative fuels through energy efficiency. Basically, talking with numbers, a 16% improvement of the efficiency of the existing fleet is possible. That means that translates basically to almost 2,500 vessels of big size in terms of consumption, and that will eventually influence the transition and the availability, the limited availability of alternative fuels. On the other hand, dropping fuels like biofuels make a very good transitional and also provide a very good solution for EU fuel EU. And of course, availability there is a very important issue. What we've seen, though, is that a lot of charterers are opting to use biofuel, even if they don't trade in the EU. So the technology there is very easy to operate. And of course, there is an ethical issue if we use biofuel instead of producing food for people. But lastly, on the new building side and new fuel uptake, we've seen that the ESG has very strong influence. If we talk about the dry bulk segment, for example, we had vessels ordered with ammonia, which is, you know, on vessels that are usually tramping. So you would expect that this vessel will initiate to burn ammonia maybe after 10 years or even more. So it will be, again, the deciding factor that the stakeholders, their ESG agenda, and of course the finance. That's
thank you, Elias. I got the key word here is alternative solutions and not the one and only fuel. But Joe, on the same subject, as IMO works towards the greenhouse gases agreement this year, how do you think it will impact the supply of green fuels? I mean, are they available?
No, that's a question we think about a lot. For the liner sector, this isn't hypothetical. Our container liner members and vehicle carriers are going to have, they have over 600 new builds on order that are coming in. So the demand clearly will exist on the water, with soon over 20% of vessels on the water in our sector having dual fuel capability. And if the supply isn't there, that's a huge problem, because dual fuel also means, you know, you could be running on the old fuel. So that's why we're working very hard at the International Maritime Organization, with the EU and others, to try to create a economic mechanism to bridge this gap. And I think it will take a lot of us, the effort to put forward to bridge that gap in a way that somehow is acceptable to the IMO community, like Gabby was saying, not just these regional structures, to make this transition, because the fuel producers need the signal. And it's like, it's a chicken and egg problem inside a chicken and egg problem, because they won't make the fuel till you burn the fuel, but you won't burn the fuel until you can, you know, burn the fuel at cost with competitors. And it's a completely legitimate business model to, you know, run an older ship for as long as you can against newer ships. But if the world community wants to go forward in this space, we're going to need to put a mechanism in place that makes this transition smooth.
Thank you, Joe. Yeah, understandable. Gordon, since you are next, okay, you heard the blockers on the green transition. Can insurance industry help on this transition, achieving decarbonization goals?
We can always help. That's the first thing to say. I just think it's worth pointing out that, you know, the chicken and egg thing is brilliant, but there's another chicken and egg going on here as well. The energy transition needs a lot more power. Okay, we need a lot more electricity to be able to achieve the energy transition. And sustainable liquid fuels in any form need bucket loads of electricity, vast quantities of electricity. And we are not seeing the generating capacity within the EU, within anywhere, being built to provide the power to make the sustainable fuels that our ship owners have gone out and prepared themselves by buying. And you know, the orders are there, the ships are going to be there, but the fuel isn't. But it's not just that the fuel isn't going to be there. I don't think the sustainable electricity supply to make that fuel is going to be there. Because I just don't think we're seeing the investment on the power side that we need on land. In terms of what the insurance industry is doing, actually recently, a couple of weeks ago, a paper went to the IMO, sponsored by the International Group and a number of countries, asking the legal committee of the IMO to look into the liability regimes and how they react to the new fuels. Because at the moment, it's not absolutely clear. It's not absolutely clear that they would react to all of the new fuels. And for investors to invest in the infrastructure that's needed in the ports, and for, you know, to protect the owners and everybody from it. It's very clear that we, it's very important that we have a clear insurance framework so that people know what the, that there aren't open-ended liabilities there that they might be taking on. Because these, some of these fuels are very dangerous. And we need to take that into account.
Yeah, I understand. I mean, if you have ammonia fuel vessel, I mean, are you ready to fully cover if, today, Gordon?
Well, the beauty of P&I clubs is that we're mutual. We're able to cover our owners for what they want to be covered for. We're owned by the owners. So, you know, that isn't necessarily, you know, a problem. But to get people to invest at scale, because we're talking about scale here. We're not talking about little
things.
We need scale.
Okay.
We need a vast amount of investment from outside of shipping as well on the infrastructure. And so we need a regime that everybody can see and everybody's comfortable with. And so hopefully the IMO will start working on that, following that paper.
Thank you, Gordon. Tim, I'll end up this part with you. I know you like this corporate sustainability reporting directives and the European sustainability standards and stuff like that. So I want to ask you, is there an impact in the shipping industry on all of this, and is tempering the current progress, or is another burden?
Thank you. Just before I come into that, I don't know, like it's a bit strong, but I certainly like talking about it. Before I come into the sustainability reporting, I think it's an interesting comment that Gordon made about there's a supply of e-ammonia, e-methanol for the shipping industry, and we put a submission into IMO back in 2022. And we estimated in that submission that you would need 771 nuclear power stations to be able to produce the amount of energy required just to supply shipping with renewable fuels. Another figure was 139,000 offshore wind turbines. So that really puts things into perspective. That was 3 years ago. But to your question, Mikhailis, just on the ESG, perhaps it's another example of a great concept, sustainability reporting, increasing transparency, and something that's been very much embraced by Danko's members, but unfortunately taken as a concept by the regulators and the politicians and absolutely ruined. And what came out of the Corporate Sustainability Reporting Directive and the Due Diligence Directive back at the end of last year, and don't get me wrong, there are Intertanker members who are having to comply with double materiality and everything else that is required here. It's a huge burden, and it's a real shame because, as a concept, it should be used for a force for good. Unfortunately, that's not exactly the way it's come out the other end. But as we've talked about, things are changing. We're in a new chapter. We have what's called the omnibus going on in Brussels at the moment. Thanks to Ursula von der Leyen's new concept and the competitiveness compass, as she calls it, a review and a rationalization of all the red tape, if you like, all the legislation in Europe, and to make sure European shipping remains competitive. So there is an opportunity, hopefully, to simplify, not water down, but simplify these requirements and make them fit for purpose. And my last comment, this is not just simply a European thing. I think this... Certainly, Intertanker's members outside of Europe are watching very closely on how the drivers for sustainability reporting evolve and what Europe does and what impact that will have on vessels trading into Europe as much as it is entities operating out of Europe.
Thank you. But concluding this part, we see that collaboration still is a need, but everything else, there is a lack of supply. Been either fuel, been electricity, whatever. So we are not ready for the decarbonization targets. And also, I see that reporting, we are ready on reporting, having everything to report on sustainability. And anyway, going to the next last and brief section on human resources, we do face talent shortage both on shore and on board, and with the new technology and digitalization. Gabby, what do you recommend? How you will attract the next generation of seafarer and shore-based?
it's difficult to tell the good stories of shipping if you, on the other side, view 14 months for the crew members of the Galaxy Leader taken hostage for nothing, for being absolutely unguilty. So how do you tell, and how can you attract young people in a situation like this? And it's only one example. I think we have to show how interesting this industry is, and to have, for example, in Germany, just as an example, we have a holiday seafarer program for our younger pupils at school. Being 16 or 17, they can spend at least 6 weeks of their summer holidays on board of a vessel if they are interested. But so they get used to what is life on board and what does it mean, how interesting our industry is, how easily you can get hold of values and have a really
excellent idea.
Yeah,
you excellent some, idea.
Yeah.
Vacation on board for high school students.
Yeah,
excellent
that's
idea.
Good. And adopt the ship is also something which is something to have also the smaller kids, to have them get used and to talk to a master on board and to show how the industry is. And another one is, okay, we become green. We are a sustainable industry, and this is also very attractive, in my view, for the Gen Z.
Very good. Elias, is the industry training enough the shore and fleet personnel to adapt to the new environment, digitalization, etc.?
Yeah, I believe there is a huge risk there for critical operations when it comes to cybersecurity. And in fact, it was addressed by IMO, and they laid the foundations for at least the basic IT and OT systems. But we believe that in terms of companies, the whole program of training, both seafarers and office people, is quite limited. Of course, there has been quite a big movement in the end of the previous decade when we had some cyber incidents, but we are still lacking in terms of planning. There is no STCW requirements in place still. The most of the companies are just now starting to integrate cyber resilience in their safety management systems. And, of course, the operational technology vulnerabilities are huge. So we need to see also the aspect of how you interface with service providers and external stakeholders.
Tim, very briefly, I know Intertanko put together a survey last year attracting seafarers to the industry. Was that, or do you continue the effort?
No, we're absolutely continuing the effort, and it was an interesting survey that we undertook, and it was just the tanker sector. And we had 5,500 respondents. And we are moving that initiative on, looking at attracting talent. And it's not necessarily a question. It's much more complex than simply attracting talent. One member was able to attract 20,000 applicants for 520 training posts in India. I think the challenge is actually looking at other countries that suffer from a lack of interest and trying to work out actually how can we attract interest there. So that's where we're going to go. In the future of the next year or two, and looking specifically at tanker issues, tanker top-up training as well for academies and so on. But because I've got a limited time, but what I want to talk about, actually, we talked about collaboration, and I think the important point, and one maybe made this afternoon, is we're just into tanker. We can just focus on what we can do. We can't influence, you know, the shape of this issue alone. And I think it's right to point about collaboration. We've come together with our roundtable partners. Yesterday, the chairman of the roundtables met and signed and put out a press release talking about fair treatment. And Gabby mentioned it this morning, just briefly.
Yes.
If we're going to attract talent.
In our fair treatment, I need to ask also Gordon and Joe. The last question, very briefly. Gordon and Joe, are there any specific strategies you recommend to attract the next generation of seafarers? And
well, I think it builds on Tim's point there. We can all influence this. And for our industry that we all love, it's very important that we are all talking to young people and talking to people about what they might be able to do and what their careers might be. And we need to encourage young people to get interested in our industry at whatever level that might be. I mean, we need to get out there and plant some trees, plant some seeds that might get people into the industry. And I think that's all of our responsibility, because otherwise we're not getting the talent that we probably need.
Yeah, we would completely agree with that. We're probably going to embark upon a reputational campaign to enhance the reputation of the industry and what we bring to the world. I mean, we've lowered trade, we've made goods and medicines more available, and we've and that has had more impact on less and least developed nations than anything. This is a tremendous career opportunity. If you've ever stood a watch at sea looking out in the room, that, you know, that is really fundamental to a lot of your careers that have done that and had that amount of responsibility. And when you see young people out there, and like Gordon said, and you talk to them, I think that's something they really crave, but the awareness level is very low, and we collectively need to do more to enhance the awareness level and the reputation of seafaring and shipping. Thank you.
Thank you, Joe. Before I thank my panelists and you for the audience for attending, I want to say one word summarizing. In order to deal with all of these challenges, being geopolitical or green sustainability, developments, shortage, I put down collaboration, adaptability, reputation, due diligence, effort to attract new talent, and the supply is not there. With this, please let me have your applause to the panelists, and thank you very much for your attention.